Case number 24-5218, United States of America versus all petroleum product cargo on board the MT Arena with International Maritime Organization number 9189952 and all petroleum product cargo on board the MT Nautilus with International Maritime Organization number 9258014, Afghan Petrokemia Co. Appellant. Mr. Santin for the appellant, Ms. Allen for the appellate.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Michael Satin on behalf of Aspen, the appellant in this case, and the claimant in the proceeding below. This case is about the limits of civil forfeiture of foreign assets. And there are two limits in this case, both as it relates to lack of U.S. nexus. The first is based on the text of the civil forfeiture statute at issue, 18 U.S.C. 981 A1G1. That statute expressly requires that any federal crime of terrorism be committed against the United States, its citizens or residents, or their property. And the amended complaint does not plausibly allege that the NAOC's federal crime of terrorism was committed against the United States, its citizens or residents, or their property. And the second comes from the underlying material support statute, section 2339B. That statute provides extraterritorial jurisdiction over a section 2339B offense where it occurs in or affects foreign commerce, and that's foreign commerce with the United States. And again, the amended complaint does not plausibly allege that the NAOC's section 2339B offense occurred in or affected foreign commerce with the United States. So those are the two arguments I'm going to focus on, as well as the government's alternative source of influence theory. So starting with the first point, that the amended complaint does not plausibly allege that the federal crime of terrorism, the NAOC's federal crime of terrorism, was against the United States, its citizens, or their property. This comes directly from the statute at issue 981A1G1. The express language is that it requires a federal crime of terrorism to be committed, quote, against the United States, citizens or residents of the United States, or their property. That language is an express element of the statute. Here, the NAOC
is familiar with any case that actually applies that as an independent requirement on top of otherwise showing a federal crime of terrorism, that actually applies the against the United States language as imposing an additional burden on the government. One way or the other, I just haven't seen a case.
Yeah, I haven't either. I think this issue has come up so rarely. I mean, even the cases that have dealt with it, there's been a handful of district court. I mean, when I say it, I mean like civil forfeiture cases that mean these sort of default judgments. I just think this is, frankly, a fairly novel issue that we're dealing with here. But the idea that it's a burden on the government, it has to be because it's an express element of the statute. And so I don't think there's any way to view this case where you would read out this crucial provision of the statute.
Well, maybe this is where you were going, but the government says even assuming it is a requirement, it's satisfied here, given the longstanding nature of the IRGC's activities and your presumed, you know, knowledge and awareness of that. So what's your factual answer?
Yeah. So a couple things. First, it's really the NAOC's crime that's at issue here. And the NAOC, we'd all agree, is not accused of any direct attack against the United States. There's no allegation that the NAOC's support of the IRGC here was with the specific purpose of it being used against the United States. In other words, there's no statement from the NAOC or the IRG says that here's some material support for you. Please use it to kill Americans or to commit some crimes here. There's nothing about the timing of the
terrorist organizations whose primary objective is to kill and maim and hurt the great Satan, which is the United States.
Yes, but when one reads the amended complaint, it's clear that that organization, the IRGC, is involved in a lot of activities within Iran and around the country. And this is coming from the government's complaint. It defends the country's political system. It engages in violence throughout the Middle East. It engages in human rights abuses within Iran and around the country. I'm not defending any of those activities, but to say that the support to the IRGC was necessarily for use against the United States is not an inference that can be drawn from the amended complaint in light of all of these other activities that are taking place.
Pretty odd rule for us to announce, right? If you're a terrorist organization that only targets the United States, you're in a worse position than if you also target a whole lot of other people, including your own citizens.
Yes, but the issue here is not the IRGC. It's not their assets that are at issue. Certainly, if it was the IRGC assets, then it would be very easy for the United States to forfeit them. There'd be no argument here. We don't represent the IRGC. We're certainly not standing up and defending their actions. The issue is this is an asset of the NIOC, and it's the NIOC's actions, their conduct in providing material support, that must be against the United States. And to be clear, it's not enough for it to be against the United States' interests. And that's the problem with the government's complaint. And I'm going to read from paragraph 29 just briefly. It says, the NIOC's use of foreign commerce to fund and provide material support to the IRGC and IRGC-QF thwart U.S. interests. And that's what the complaint talks about, U.S. interests. They often, in another place, they talk about, paragraph 28, that the actions of the NIOC are contrary to the interests of the United States. That's not the language of the statute. It's got to be against the United States, which can only be interpreted as sort of like the soil, the land of the United States, its residents or citizens or residents. In other words, you know, U.S. citizens or residents or the property of United States citizens. It can't be the interests of the United States. And that's how they read it. Now, that's not how they read it. That's how they've pled it. And of course, here we are at a in a civil forfeiture case where there's a heightened pleading standard, right? That under supplemental rule G2F, the government must state, quote, sufficiently detailed facts. And they haven't done that. They've alleged that the actions of the NAOC are against the interests of the United States. And that is not enough. There's an independent provision here as it relates to a crime that's committed against the United States, its citizens or residents, or their property.
Can I just ask about the foreign commerce argument?
Sure.
Maybe this is oversimplifying, but I thought in Park we said we basically apply the interstate effects tests that we have from cases like Wickard v. Filburn. And so it struck me that this case is as if Mr. Filburn was growing and consuming within Ohio $500 million worth of wheat every year, and said, well, I wasn't doing it in interstate commerce. And I think we all know how that would come out. Why isn't that exactly what's going on here?
I think it depends on what the it is here. And I'm not...
The it is, you may be entirely correct. It is limited to whatever activities constitute NIOC's material support of IRGC. And we don't have a number for that, but it's sure a lot. And again, Mr. Filburn making... you know, consuming $10,000 worth of wheat, much less hundreds of millions, doesn't seem like a close case.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. I appreciate that question. First, I do think it's important to be clear about what the it is. And the it is limited to the NIOC's Section 2339B offense. That's the conduct that, according to the statute, must have the effect on foreign commerce with the United States. So it's not the IRGC's activities. It's not the Iranian regime's activities. It's not the NAOC's general commercial activities, like what they're doing with Venezuela or Iran. It's got to be their specific offense here. And when we look at the amended complaint, what does it say on that very issue? First of all, most of the amended complaint, or a lot of it, is not even about the NAOC. It's about the conduct of the IRGC.
So let me, if I think... it is a plausible inference that at least, say, $1 million worth of NIOC's business goes and is delivered to the IRGC, and that constitutes part of this offense of terrorism, then would you agree that that is enough to constitute an effect on foreign commerce with the United States?
No, because what Your Honor has just said says nothing about what the effect is on foreign commerce, and that needs to be alleged with facts. And that's what we don't have. We have an amended complaint that talks largely about the actions of the IRGC. When it talks about the actions of the NAOC, part of it is just general, what it does, generally its commercial activities, but nothing about the effect of its Section 2339B's offense, that conduct, its effect on foreign commerce. I think in paragraph 29, there's one sort of confusing and sentence, a conclusory sentence, that these activities undertaken in foreign commerce plainly have a domestic effect on the United States and its domestic commerce. That's it. A single conclusory vague sentence. But there are no facts alleged about what that effect would be. And remember, we're dealing with Iranian oil. The United States doesn't trade in Iranian oil. There's no allegation here that the United States is engaged in the illegal trading of Iranian oil. So there's nothing here about how that NAOC conduct has an effect on foreign commerce.
What about paragraph 72? It seems to be trying to make the basic economic point that if Iran does or does not inject massive amounts of oil into global markets will affect the price of oil.
Right. And if I direct your Honor's attention to the beginning of the third or the second sentence of that paragraph, because after talking about the NOC, it says, as the IRGC and IRGCQF's wrongful actions affect United States commerce. So once again, the amended complaint is talking about the actions of the IRGC and their effect, the actions, their conduct and how it affects foreign commerce. We're not here talking that. That's not the issue here. And the government talks about sealed case. I want to bring that up. Because I know they put a lot of eggs in that basket. And I know that Judge Henderson was involved in that case and wrote a brilliant concurrence in it. But the point of the sealed case and why it's so easily distinguished from this case is because the extraterritorial jurisdictional provision in sealed case expressly said that one may consider the effect of the terrorist organization, that the entity that's receiving material support. The specific language in sealed case is, there's jurisdiction over an offense where, quote, the offense, the prohibited drug activity, or the terrorist offense occurs in or affects foreign commerce. So in sealed case, we have jurisdiction based on, in this case, if that were the case, the actions of the IRGC. We don't have that. We have a statute that's just limited to the actions of the NAOC. And the other really important distinction between our case and sealed case is that in sealed case, the defendant admitted that his actions affected U.S. commerce. No party here has admitted that the NIOC's conduct affected U.S. foreign commerce or U.S. commerce.
One aspect of sealed case that might hurt you, though, is that the effect was inferred from the size of the drug transactions, right?
That's true. And what's hard about sealed case is that we don't know which countries we're talking about and how close they are to the United States. But I think there is an inference drawn in sealed case. I don't know if it's an inference where there's actually facts alleged that the United States is involved in the drug trade. So we know that illegal drugs that are being moved in the sealed case has an effect on the United States because the United States is engaged in the illegal drug market. And here we're dealing with Iranian oil. Again, the United States is, by law, is not allowed to trade in Iranian oil. There's no allegation that the United States is illegally doing that. But even that factual distinction aside, I think the two important distinctions are that the underlying criminal statute in sealed case expressly allowed jurisdiction based on the actions of the terrorist group that receives material support. And second, that really that there had been an admission by the defendant that his actions affected U.S. commerce, which we don't have here.
It's a fair point that the terrorist offense language in the sealed case statute broadens things a little bit. Well, it broadens things relative to the statute here, but still keyed to a specific offense, right? And yet, we seem to have no trouble just saying there a lot of drugs are involved and that affects commerce and that's close enough.
Well, I guess I don't read it that way. And to the extent there's the courts are suggesting there's like a drug exceptionalism or kind of that drugs are a certain way. I read the case as yes, there's a lot of drugs involved.
Let's try it this way. This is the easiest case in the world against you if one is allowed to apply the aspect of Wickard that allows going from Mr. Filburn is doing to, you know, growing weed in the aggregate substantially affects interstate commerce. Like, does the support here in the aggregate substantially affect foreign commerce? Like, obviously. And you're saying that's the wrong inquiry because the statute, not the foreign commerce clause, but the statute focuses on the offense.
Right. I think that's one thing. I also think that.
And that's what I'm wondering. The sealed case statute is offense specific. in the same way. And yet we have the result that we have.
Right. And I think it's also important to recognize the unique procedural posture of this case, because it's actually evaluating an amended complaint, not looking at the, say, constitutionality or the scope of the statute directly. And really, that's the issue here. What facts have been alleged in this complaint for which there is a heightened standard? And it doesn't make those allegations or factual allegations. I don't know if it could. The district court dismissed granted the motion dismissed the first time around, gave the government leave to amend. They made, frankly, on that very issue, the foreign effects issue, they made very minor changes in the court. It was enough for the district court below, but there aren't factual allegations, and that's what we need here. So I think this posture is also unique here. Realize I'm over time, though I'm happy to continue to answer questions.
Was there a statutory question in Park, or was it pure foreign commerce clause? There we did specifically embrace the aggregation aspect.
Right. Of a U.S. citizen, mind you, and that the fact that he was a U.S. citizen was crucial to the decision in that case.
All right, we'll give you a couple of minutes in reply. Ms. Allen.
Thank you, Your Honor. Catherine Allen on behalf of the United States. I would just like to pick up with the discussion of In Re Sealed case, just to make very clear why we think that that case is relevant here, even though the extraterritorial jurisdictional provisions there were different. According to Aspen, the extraterritorial jurisdictional provision in this case, where it says affects foreign commerce, should be read basically as a term of art that refers to Congress's authority under the Foreign Commerce Clause. In Re Sealed case, what this court did was it addressed the scope of the Foreign Commerce Clause, and it held that criminal conduct very similar to the conduct that's at issue here satisfied that test. So we think that this case fits very comfortably within this court's decision in Sealed case. There, the question was whether the defendant's drug trafficking that was used to support foreign terrorist organizations affected U.S. commerce, and the court looked to both the effect of the drug trafficking itself as well as the effect of the of the terrorism. And I think here, both of those aspects are equally present.
I think their best argument has to focus not on an effects test, because the statute on its face says affects foreign commerce. It has to be the word offense, which says don't aggregate all of the support from the beginning of time to these U.S. focused terrorist entities. Just look at this one charged offense and ask whether this one. It's like an anti-Wickard aggregation principle that comes from the word offense.
Well, Your Honor, the material support offense that's alleged here is an ongoing offense because NIOC, the complaint alleges that NIOC is the institutional mechanism that is the primary source of funding for these two terrorism or foreign terrorist organizations that routinely attack the United States and have done so
for decades. It's not limited to the oil that was on these two ships?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The forfeiture provision at issue here states that all assets, foreign or domestic, of an entity that's engaged in planning or perpetrating a federal crime of terrorism are subject to forfeiture to the United States. And
right. So, and the predicate crime is material support.
That's
correct. Sorry, how is that charged? What was the material support?
Well, Your Honor, the complaint alleges a number of ways in which NIOC provides material support to NIOC and its subsidiaries provide material support to the IRGC and IRGCQF.
Beyond just this oil.
Yes, Your Honor. And Aspen, in the district court, didn't even contest that when you look beyond this particular oil, and the all assets language makes clear that we're not talking about just this particular oil. We're talking about NIOC's material support in general.
Over time.
Okay. And again, that
Is there a time limit on that in the complaint? Is there, in terms of the offense? We're really just talking about everything NIOC has ever done.
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but if about what particular time limit there would be, but just to point you to one specific allegation in the complaint and in the accompanying documents, this is paragraph 40 of the complaint and supplemental appendix 21. It says that in the spring of 2019 alone, NIOC provided material support by with respect to 10 million barrels of oil sold for over $500 million and 4 million barrels of condensate sold for over $250 million. I mean, that's just one instance that's in the complaint. And there's no question that this vast scale of trade in illicit oil, putting that onto the black market, affects the U.S. trade in oil as well. And again, we don't just need to look at that, because also there's the fact that by providing this material support to the IRGC and IRGC-QF, NIOC is is enabling those two organizations to commit terrorism attacks against the United States. And that's why the terrorism is important, because by funding those organizations, being the primary source of funding to those organizations, you can look to their terrorism as well. And that's what this court did in Ray Seal case, was to look to both the effect of the drug trafficking activity as well as the terrorism of the foreign terrorist organizations.
Just on the calculation requirement, do you think we've decided exactly how this intent requirement works, or do you think, are you asking us to essentially adopt the Second Circuit's test from the Awan case, the idea that this needs to be calculated to affect government conduct or U.S. government conduct?
Well, I think a lot of courts of appeals have adopted the Awan test. I don't know that the specific issue, I guess I think... the element is clearly satisfied. I guess I'm not sure what two different versions of the test.
You agree that it's more than just knowledge that this money is going to go to support terrorist attacks. It's, we need to be able to infer an intent that those terrorist attacks.
That's correct. And I mean, this court has said that it's an intent requirement. And I think, you know, just to be clear, we're not talking about a one-off donation to the IRGC. We're not talking about opening a couple of social media accounts for people who sympathize with the IRGC. You know, what we're talking about here is being the primary source of funding, the institutionalized, role for this entity is to be the source of funding for these terrorist organizations. So I think it's very reasonable to infer, based on the facts alleged in the complaint, that the material support offense is calculated to influence the conduct of government by intimidation and coercion. And there's the other thing I would point to again is there are a number of allegations in the complaint alleging direct coordination between NIOC officials and the IRGC. So again, it's not like some arm's length donation, as in some of the cases, or doing business with a third party. We're talking about a lot of direct cooperation and coordination. And so that further supports the inference that they provided material support with the intent that it would be calculated to influence the U.S. government.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we urge the court to affirm.
All right. Thank you.
On the calculated to issue, I know I didn't talk about it previously, and it seems that the government is kind of drawing or making assumptions that, of course, it must have been done for this purpose or another purpose. But that's not enough here, and it's similar to the against the United States provision, but it's a slightly different argument. It is a specific intent. What was the specific intent of the NIOC when material support was provided to the NIOC, to the IRGC? And we don't know. This complaint does not tell us. Doesn't provide any facts. There are no statements from the NIOC. Here's why we're providing support to you. There are no statements from the IRGC. Here's why we've received support for it. There's nothing about the timing of that transfer that would say it was done for this specific purpose. And as to the question, I know Judge Garcia asked about kind of timing. The statute uses sort of the gerund form of perpetrating. So there has to be some contemporaneity to it. And I agree with Judge Casquez, or at least the suggestion from his question, that you cannot aggregate all of these different things and say, oh, there must be an effect.
So what is your view on, to me, this comes down to the word offense on the predicate charged material support, which I had maybe wrongly been assuming, well, the charged offense is the oil on the two ships. And that's more like what Filburn himself is consuming, not everyone in the world who consumes wheat. But maybe that's not right.
No, that is right. It has to, well, not.
Well, your colleague says the charge defense is more acts of material support.
I don't disagree that that the amended complaint says in a fairly vague way, in a non-specific way, that there has been material support just beyond the particular oil that's at issue here.
Why can't they do that? Sort of make the case, this is a pattern in practice, this is institutionalized. What's the oil on these ships is just one instance of a much broader pattern of support.
Well, because the effect on foreign commerce is linked to the specific offense. So they have to say, all right, they have to identify the particular offense, which is hardly done here. It's so vague, and say this particular offense. So let's use the example
it's institutionalized support over time.
Well, but that doesn't work with the contemporaneity of the statute. That has to be at around the time of the seizure of the oil. We can't look at events that happened in the past. We have to look at events that are happening right now.
Let's just take it out of these facts. It's almost just confusing that the asset seized is oil. The fact is, if the complaint said, in the past 5 years, NIOC has engaged in, you know, $500 million in business and transporting oil and in other ways, and all of that goes to materially supporting IRGC, that would be the offense. And then they might say, hey, look, we seized this ship that has oil on it. But that's what we're getting at. There's a distinction between the asset seized and the offense, right? And you have a lot of maybe compelling arguments about that the offense is narrow. But if it were alleged the way that I just said, then we would be focused on that $500 million of activity, the offense, and whether that activity affects interest foreign commerce. Do you disagree with that legal setup?
I think I do, because I don't know how there can be a material support that is this ongoing campaign. It's almost like court suggesting a conspiracy. I don't think that's certainly not what's been pled here. What's been pled is a specific offense. I understand the government is suggesting that there are more than one.
Specific offenses in the past 5 years, the IRGC NIOC has given the IRGC $500 million. Then right. We would ask, does that have an effect on foreign commerce, right?
Right. And to be clear, a couple of things. First, there would have to be proof or allegations, factual allegations, specific factual allegations, the amended complaint that said that provision of $500 million had an effect on foreign commerce.
Yes.
And it's also interesting to note that there's actually no allegations here really of even as it relates to like the specific oil at issue, that there actually was this transfer of money. They talk about this kind of service, but they don't really say that money is actually being provided. I think the government is being fairly loose in the way they're talking about the NIOC as the primary funder. That's actually not what the amended complaint says. So I take the court's hypothetical. I'd want to think about it some more, but it's pretty far afield from the amended complaint that we have here.
All right. Thank you.